From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a conversation with Koki Roberts, political analyst for NPR and ABC TV. She's one of the leading experts on Congress. She was practically raised in the halls of Congress. Her father, Hale Boggs, was the majority leader in the House. We'll talk with Koki Roberts about how growing up in a political family shaped her work as a journalist. And we send jazz critic Kevin Whitehead to the movies. He has a review of Sliver, starring Sharon Stone, William Baldwin, and Tom Berenger. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Clinton expressed skepticism today about Russian and European plans to stop the fighting in Bosnia. The president warned that efforts to protect Bosnian Muslims in so-called safe havens could create a situation like those in Lebanon or Northern Ireland. The president made his comments after a meeting today with Russian Foreign Minister Andrei Kozyrev. Later on, State Department spokesman Richard Boucher said that the United States continues to believe that stronger measures may be needed to end the fighting. He stressed, though, that the United States is not in a position to get agreement on such measures from the allies now. An independent commission in South Africa says it's investigating new allegations that military hit squads have targeted officials of the African National Congress and other black activists. NPR's Ann Cooper reports from Johannesburg.
The Commission on Public Violence, headed by Judge Richard Goldstone, said a witness has alleged that six teams of gunmen were recruited by South African military intelligence to assassinate black activists. Among the alleged targets were some lower-level regional ANC leaders. The witness told the commission that he was given a gun, ammunition, and a hit list by a military intelligence official. The defense ministry tonight denied the charges and said the witness had left South African military service in 1991. The allegations are certain to fuel a new round of accusations of government complicity in political violence. I'm Ann Cooper in Johannesburg.
There's still no agreement on side deals to the North American Free Trade Agreement. Negotiators for the United States, Canada, and Mexico ended a third round of talks in Ottawa today, saying serious differences remain. Jennifer Ludden reports from Ottawa.
Negotiators said they found broad consensus in their discussions on environmental and labor regulations. The deadlock is over how to enforce such rules. The United States wants tough trade sanctions to ensure compliance, but Canada's chief negotiator told reporters that approach is too adversarial. He said Canada prefers a cooperative and consultative mechanism to work out disputes that may arise among the three countries. The official said there was no talk of a deal on import surges, again something the United States wants, but Canada and Mexico have resisted. The U.S. negotiator said he plans to present such a proposal later. A fourth round of talks is scheduled for early June in Washington. For National Public Radio, I'm Jennifer Ludden reporting.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost more than 30 points today to close at 3,493. The NASDAQ Composite Index was down 3.1 at 694.3. Declining issues led advances by a margin of 11-7 in heavy trading. This is NPR. Talks aimed at ending the civil war in Angola broke up today without agreement and were suspended indefinitely. The United Nations-sponsored talks were held in Abidjan, the capital of Ivory Coast, under the leadership of UN Special Envoy Margaret Anstey. UN Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali had given the two sides until today to come up with an agreement. Anstey said the talks failed on the key issue of whether UNITA rebels should withdraw from areas they seized after the fighting began again late last year. Four people died today in an apparent murder-suicide in a small town in South Dakota. Colin Strombeck of the South Dakota Public Radio Network reports.
30-year-old Carl Swanson shot and killed his 25-year-old wife and two of their children this morning with a .38-caliber handgun. He also critically injured another son. Hosmer resident Mary Jo Moore says the small town is in a state of disbelief.
absolute shock. I mean, you don't think of something like this happening in a town 350 population. You know, it's something that you don't expect to happen here.
The deputy state attorney general says divorce proceedings may have been the cause. The prosecutor says the victims had recently moved to town. She and two of the children were shot in her yard. Carl Swanson's body was found in a car outside of town where he shot another son and himself. For National Public Radio, I'm Colin Strombeck reporting.
Reports from Ukraine say that at least one man was killed today in an explosion and fire at a nuclear power station. The extent of the fire damage wasn't immediately known. The Reuters news agency quoted a local official in Ukraine as saying that the fire was touched off by sparks from a welder's torch that ignited hydrogen in a pipe from one of the station's six reactors. A report on Ukrainian television said that radiation levels in the area haven't risen as a result of the incident. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Many of us feel indebted to Cokie Roberts for deepening our understanding of Congress. She's also one of the reporters who established NPR's reputation for excellent reporting. She joined NPR in 1978 and covered Congress for 13 years. Now she's a political analyst for NPR and ABC TV. Sunday mornings, she spars with George Will and Sam Donaldson on The Brinkley Show. It wouldn't be an exaggeration to say politics is in her blood. Her father, Hale Boggs, served in Congress for 32 years and became House Majority Leader. Her mother took over his seat after his 1972 death in a plane crash. Even Cokie's husband, Steve Roberts, has a connection to Congress. He writes about politics for U.S. News & World Report. Last night, I interviewed Cokie Roberts at the WHYY Forum Theater in Philadelphia before an audience of about 500 people. Thank you all for coming. Cokie, before the year of the woman and all that, you were one of the very few women covering Congress. And even before you were covering Congress, your mother was one of the few women in Congress. I'd like you to think back a few years to when you started covering Congress, to when it was even more of a men's club than it is now. What were some of the obstacles you were up against as a woman covering Congress?
Actually, not any. That is something that's interesting about politicians. They are the most modern of men when they need to be. If you are representing a news organization, as in my case, National Public Radio, which is in every single one of their districts, they don't care what you are. I've always joked, you know, if you walked in and you were a three-headed monster and polka-dotted, they would say, and you had 10 million listeners, they would say, oh, you know, after a moment, hi, have a cup of coffee, or perhaps you need three. But it is, they were perfectly willing to talk to me or to any of my female colleagues because of the organizations we represented. The problems were much more in the news organizations rather than among the sources.
Were you turned down for a lot of jobs that you thought you should have gotten,
sure,
except for the fact that you were a woman?
Absolutely.
Were you told point blank that it was because
blank,
you were a woman?
Point blank. We don't hire women to do that. Their voices lack authority, or we don't hire women writers because men have to work for the writers, and obviously men can't work for women. I mean, every imaginable thing was said of the reasons they couldn't hire you. You'll leave because you'll get pregnant, all of that. And it was all said straight out loud. And in some ways, it's refreshing because there was no pretense. It was exactly what it is, what they said was what they meant.
Did you ever challenge it or consider challenging it?
No. You could, by the time I really, you know, was having a job hunt where it came up over and over again was right after I was married, and it was 1966, and it was in New York. And by then, it was against the law, and I could have gone around suing people and never worked for the rest of my life. That was an option.
Well, let's jump ahead to the president a little bit. You're working in TV and radio now. And you've made the transition from reporter to reporter and news analyst. Is it difficult sometimes to say something critical about somebody who you're covering as a reporter? To criticize somebody as an analyst and then go back and report on them in an objective way and so on?
Well, I think that people generally, now there's this varies tremendously from person to person. Generally, people in politics feel that as long as you're fair, that they can take the criticism.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, some people think that the only fair thing you can say about them is the great and glorious senator from, you know, awakened this morning to do good for the people of his state and of America as a whole. Most of them are more reasonable than that.
Right. What was it like the first time you were one of the panelists on The Brinkley Show on a Sunday morning?
Scary.
It was like an initiation.
It really was. And I think it took some time to be accepted by the guys and all of that, but it was an interesting challenge. I was very aware. I don't want to dwell too much on this woman thing because obviously my life has been very good and very blessed. But it was a situation that I knew because I was a middle-aged woman who had been in the toiling in the vineyards for a very long time, that I could not behave in the same fashion as a man would have coming into that situation, and that I had to, A, in the private setting before the program, be respectful and silent, and then on the air, let viewers get used to me before I really started jumping in more and interjecting more, because otherwise there's a reaction of sort of, who is that woman and why is she saying that and where did she come from and, you know, why is she being so aggressive, you know, a positive word about a man, a negative one about a woman. And it's a delicate balance, because if you don't say anything, then you're a wallflower who doesn't have anything to say, and get her out of there. But if you jump in too much and are too ready to put yourself forward before people get to know you and feel comfortable with you, then you get all of the female words applied, shrill, et cetera.
Mm. No, and I know you started in television, but you became best known for radio, and now you're in both radio and TV. When people who listened to you started watching you as well, did your image change? Did the adjectives used to describe you change?
It was the looks on their faces that was so upsetting. I mean, this look of disappointment. Oh, that's not what I thought she looked like. Sure, people do react differently. Radio is, as you well know, such a wonderful medium.
When you started at ABC, was there somebody who was paid to say, well, but now that you're doing TV, of course you're going to have to do your hair differently and do your makeup and dress differently, too, and all of that?
Well, I don't know. I assume they're all paid, and a lot of them said it. But they... And look, I always am uncomfortable with these statements, these questions, because it makes me sound like I'm some sort of prim, you know, opponent of makeup. Quite the contrary, I've been trying to get the makeup man to move in with me for years, and I mean, I am delighted to look good. You know, nothing makes me happier than looking like a better version of myself. But that's who I have to look like, is myself. And so there's been a continuing fight over these long skirts that I wear. And I just cannot imagine sitting with trying to make an argument and make a forceful point against Sam tugging on my skirt. You know, it's one thing too many to think about. But... as you know, I've said before, and I want to say it again, I cannot be a glamorous 22-year-old. I am the mother of a glamorous 22-year-old, and there is reason to behave like my age.
I really admire the way you host Nightline when I've
Thank
seen you.
You
host it, and I think you're really great in getting people to actually answer a question and stopping them from gassing on if they're so inclined, which is among the harder things to do when you're interviewing people in politics.
It's particularly hard to do politely.
Yes, exactly, exactly. You grew up in a political family. I mean, your father was a lifelong politician. Your mother entered into politics.
No, my mother was a lifelong politician.
But she actually got a seat in Congress after your father passed. I wonder what your exposure to journalists was when you were growing up. Yeah. Uh-huh.
We have a famous story in our family, but it's a very useful story
mm-hmm.
for someone who is a journalist to have as her sort of formative story about the press. My father ran for governor in 1952, but the real sort of race was throughout 1951. The election was in January 52, so I was seven throughout the race. I was just turned eight when he got when the election happened. It was in Louisiana. It was at a time when it was pretty much a one-party state. You had a first primary, and then the second primary was the election. And he came in third, a very bitter, unbelievably nasty campaign, nasty by Louisiana standards. And well, remember, this is the middle of the McCarthy era, all of that. And he came in third. The person who comes in third in a situation like that is very influential in terms of the runoff and how he throws his votes and the rest of it. The counting had gone on all night long, and the phone rang the morning after the election. And my sister, who was 12, answered the phone. And the person on the other end asked to speak to my father, and she said, he's asleep and he's been up all night, and I will not awaken him. And the guy on the other end says, well, what does he think about the election? And Barbara says, well, he knows he lost. And but then she at 12 had the sense to say, you know, who is this anyway? And he said that he was a reporter for the afternoon paper. And she said, look, I'm only 12 years old. You can't use a word I said to you. And that afternoon's paper came out with the headline, Source Close to Hale Boggs Concedes Election. So,
oh, no.
Oh, yes. And that is and that kind of thing happens much more often than any of us would like to believe. And it's a very useful thing. I gave a graduation speech at Columbia Journalism School a few years ago, and I started with first do no harm. And I think that it is a very useful thing to have been on the other side.
Do you think that you're more thoughtful of the privacy of politicians because of the situation you grew up in?
I do think I am more concerned about their privacy, but I also just see them much more as human beings, you know, as people with all the flaws and foibles and families of a human being, and that brings with it the respect that I have for human beings, but also the humor that I have about us all.
You know, your mother was in Congress during several years when
the whole time. Yeah.
So was that awkward, and was that a conflict of interest?
No, it was wonderful. It was grand to have my mother there. My mother is, for any of you who've had the treat of knowing her, a truly special person, and it was so nice to be able to have her in a place where I could visit with her and it wasn't Sunday dinner, you know. But in terms of conflict, the only problem that it presented was one for my mother, not for me.
How was it a problem
because,
for her?
Because there were stories where she really should have been the key player on the air in the story, and she wasn't because I was doing the story, so that she was left out of something that where she really shouldn't have been left out of it. And I'm sure that there were times when it was very hard for her that I was being as tough as I was being on whatever the issue was. I know that, for instance, during the period when Jim Wright was having his troubles up to his resignation, that must have been a very difficult time for my mother to have me in the position that I was in. And to be in the position she was in. But my mother is one of the world's incredible human beings, and she would just never, she understands that I have my job and she has her job.
We'll return to our interview with Cokie Roberts after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
We're featuring an interview with NPR and ABC political analyst Cokie Roberts. It was recorded last night at the WHYY Forum Theater.
Now, isn't it true that Perot had you on a short list for vice president?
Very short list, just me and a dead person.
Did he talk to you about it? Did he call you up or anything?
No, he didn't talk to me about it.
So how'd you find out about it?
And I assume he didn't talk to the dead person either.
Who's the dead person?
Dead person was William French Smith. This story was told to me by Ed Rollins, who, as you recall, was the Republican operative who went down with Sam Ham Jordan during the summertime campaign. And Rollins claims that he was handed this list with our two names on it and was told it was the short list for vice president. I've since had some Perot people question it. However, I've had six more people come back and confirm it, so I believe it.
So what was this about,
Who knows what it was about? I mean, what is any of it about? But it's all mysterious to me. But the only thing that I can guess is that I had written an op-ed piece for the New York Times where I was analyzing why the Americans were so amazed by both political parties and ready to agree with Perot's assessment that it was all goofy. I mean, it was at a time when, as you recall, the salient issue before the public was whether Murphy Brown was right or wrong to have this baby. I mean, please, this is a fictional character. And they're grown-up men arguing about it in both political parties and taking, became very serious. And then, I did feel that the public felt that they had heard plenty of silly stuff from politicians and that that was Perot's appeal. But as often happens, people do confuse analysis with advocacy. I mean, I was explaining it, not endorsing it.
Do you think you would have done better than Stockdale did at the debate?
I certainly would have done better at the debate because... Not to take anything away from Admiral Stockdale, who I think basically won the debate, but the... I mean it. What was needed at that debate, however, was a mother. And, boys, go to your rooms. This is unacceptable behavior. I mean, really. I gather that modern mothers now have this thing they say, time out. I love it. And that would have been perfect, Time out, boys. Hush now.
When I was growing up, my father was a millinery, and I had a sketchy idea of what he did, but I didn't really know for sure. When you were growing up, When you were growing up, your father was in Congress. How much of an idea did you have
of what he was doing? No, I knew. My father first ran for Congress before I was born, and Barbara was 15 months, and Tommy was born the week after he was elected. He was defeated 2 years later, went into the Navy, and then was reelected in 1946 when I was three, when I was two, really, when he was reelected. And so all of my life, he was in politics, and we were incredibly involved. My mother and he had gone to college together. He had been editor of the college paper. She had been women's editor. And they had formed with a group of other young people a political reform group in Louisiana. Think of it. And it was to oust the successors of Huey Long. It was a very terrifying period. It was really a Hitlerian dictatorship. And they were engaged in a cause, and that was how they came into politics. My father first ran; he was 25, and I think about it now, from my perspective of age, and thinking of my mother going to Washington at age 24 with these two babies. Think of it, before World War II, and Washington was still a very formal city with a great deal of protocol. I mean, I've always admired her greatly, but now when I realize what her life was like, I admire her even more. But they were very determined that we would be involved in their political lives, that we would have no family life otherwise. And so we went on every campaign trip. We gave speeches from the tiniest of ages. It's no accident that all three of us have ended up doing something in the talking realm for a living.
Well, stop right here. Do you remember any of the speeches that you had to give?
No, I don't. But I do remember. I'm sure they would vote for Hale Boggs.
Vote for my dad.
But make Louisiana better, or something. You know, keep the Mississippi River here, whatever. That was very much part of our lives, and we went to Congress all the time. We went to school half year each place, so it was. I mean, our lives were the rhythm of the congressional season, and if there was an important bill up, we skipped school and went and watched the legislation. My mother felt, you know, arithmetic would always be there. We might not learn it, but it would always be there, and. You know, so I very much knew what he was doing.
Did you have to ever be the exemplary daughter on the campaign trail?
Always the exemplary daughter. I suppose it's only worse than being the minister's child. But as a Catholic, this wasn't an issue. I have. It's interesting because that's given me both sympathy for and yet a sort of a toughness about. Political families, because on the one hand, I do understand what they're going through. On the other hand, sort of my reaction is, well, so shape up and do it, you know.
What did you have to do to be exemplary?
It's what you couldn't do.
What couldn't you do? What couldn't you do that everybody else was doing?
You couldn't go to bars as you got older. You couldn't be in a position where you were cutting up and people would find out. I mean, you had to be much better behaved in public than our friends would be. I mean, we're talking, keep in mind, New Orleans, Louisiana, you know. This is not a city that is known for its Puritan ethic, unlike your own. And we were always aware that people knew who we were and that we did have to behave. And then, as we got older, there were all of the civil rights battles going on, and we were on one side, and the rest of the city was on the other, the rest of the white city, and that became very difficult. It became something where people would say hurtful things, and you would want to fight back, and you would fight back to some degree, but you had to be careful exactly how far you fought.
But you were usually on the same side of political issues that your parents were?
Until the Vietnam War.
And then what happened?
Well, we did the same thing every other young family, you know. all of the youth of America was on one side and all of the older people on another for a long time, and then it changed.
Because your father had the power to vote and was also very influential, probably to even the president.
Sure, of course. He was a leader in the House of Representatives.
So did you try to change his mind?
Sure.
Did you think there's no way you were going to ever do that, so why
try? No. We always argued. But we always did from day one. I mean, it was a household where that was valued. It was not discouraged. No one expected you to agree.
Cookie Roberts is a political analyst for NPR and ABC TV. Our interview was recorded last night at the WHYY Forum Theater. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. We'll hear more from Cokie on the second part of our show.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, more with Cokie Roberts about politics, journalism, and her family. Roberts is political analyst for NPR and ABC TV. Her father, Congressman Hale Boggs, disappeared in a plane crash over 20 years ago, and her mother took over his seat in Congress. Also, Kevin Whitehead reviews the new psychosexual mystery, Sliver, starring Sharon Stone, William Baldwin, and Tom Berenger. Kevin is filling in for film critic Stephen Schiff, while Stephen is at the Cannes Film Festival. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. There's a report that the White House has dropped the travel agency it had hired to temporarily take over travel operations after seven travel office employees were fired this week. The Associated Press quotes an administration official as saying the Arkansas agency was dropped today after disclosure of a memo showing that a distant cousin of the president had proposed taking over the travel office 3 months before its staff was fired, and she was named to help oversee the operations. On Capitol Hill, in the opening round of debate over campaign finance reform legislation, Democratic and Republican senators took opposite sides. The GOP opposes the president's proposal, which includes spending limits and public financing of campaigns. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
The Senate took up campaign finance reform today, with Democrats demanding that Congress end the money chasing. But Republicans charge the effort is a con game. Senate Minority Leader Bob Dole says Democrats are hoping for a GOP filibuster.
The Democrats are quietly cheering in the cloakroom that we kill the bill.
The president's proposal includes voluntary spending limits in exchange for vouchers for television and other advertising, and an end to contributions by political action committees. Senator Dole says no effort has been made to negotiate with Republicans, who say the bill gives the advantage to Democratic lawmakers. He says he may propose setting up a neutral commission to make recommendations instead. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
France's defense minister has suggested a multinational European corps be sent to Bosnia, but Germany has ruled out taking part in any such action. Deidre Berger reports from Frankfurt.
The proposal for a broader European military involvement in Yugoslavia came during a meeting between the French and German defense ministers. They spoke in Mülheim in Germany, the headquarters of a Franco-German brigade that will be upgraded to a corps by 1995. French Defense Minister François Léotard said the proposed Eurocorps could be deployed by the UN for a mission in Bosnia. Léotard also pushed for a UN resolution bolstering UN peacekeeping units in Bosnia. France currently has about 5,000 soldiers there. German Defense Minister Volker Rühe agreed the future Eurocorps could be dispatched on UN missions, but Rühe said unequivocally there will be no German ground troops in Bosnia. The German government fears the presence of German soldiers in Rump Yugoslavia would complicate the situation because of continuing resentment of Germany's World War II invasion. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in Frankfurt.
The Treasury Department says the government had an $8 billion budget surplus last month because of income tax payments. At the same time, the nation's deficit declined to $174 billion. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down more than 30 points to close at 3,492.83 on volume of 273 million shares. This is NPR News. According to news reports from Moscow, agreement has been reached between the Russian government, the central bank, and the International Monetary Fund on credit policies for Russia in the future. Economists have said that loose monetary policies in Russia are a major cause of climbing inflation there. In order for Moscow to get a $3 billion loan from the IMF, it has to pledge to continue moving to a free market economy. The World Health Organization estimates that there are now 14 million people infected with the AIDS virus around the world. NPR's Joe Palca has more on the story.
Getting an accurate picture of the number of infections worldwide is tricky, since many countries don't have adequate resources to measure the spread of the disease. But even with this uncertainty, WHO says it's clear that the AIDS virus is continuing to spread at an alarming rate. The estimate of 14 million infections released today is up 1 million from 6 months ago. sub-Saharan Africa still accounts for more than half of all infections. But according to the World Health Organization, the most alarming news is the number of new infections in parts of Asia. The epidemic is spreading in South and Southeast Asia at a rate similar to the explosive spread Africa experienced a decade ago. WHO estimates that more than 1.5 million people are infected in Asia, with the majority of infections in India and Thailand. In Washington, I'm Joe Palca.
In Venezuela, the nation's Senate has given the go-ahead to the Supreme Court to try President Carlos Perez on embezzlement charges. The 70-year-old leader is the first sitting president in Venezuela to face such charges since his country became a democracy 35 years ago. His own Democratic Action Party supported a trial because it said it is confident of a fair trial and acquittal. Perez is accused of stealing more than $17 million in government money. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Today we're featuring an interview with Koki Roberts. You probably know Koki from her congressional reporting and political analysis on NPR and ABC TV. Last night at the WHYY Forum Theater, I spoke with Koki about how growing up in a political family affected her work as a journalist. Her father, the late Hale Boggs, was in Congress for 32 years and became House Majority Leader. Your father disappeared in a plane crash on a campaign tour through Alaska in 1972. I know he was never found. Was the plane ever found?
No. It's really remarkable. It was at the end of a congressional session, and the people who were there, I learned different things about it all the time still from people. He was exhausted. At the end of a congressional session, you always are. You haven't been to bed for days, and he was majority leader, so he'd been, running the House. And a young congressman from Alaska, a freshman, had begged him to come and campaign for him, and he desperately didn't want to go, I'm told, at the end. That, it's such a long trip, and then the campaigning is difficult, and it always involves moving around in little planes, which he never liked. But off he went because he had promised to do it, and there he did. The plane never left from Anchorage, never arrived in Juneau. And the most extensive search in American history was launched, and not only by the good folk of Alaska, who were quite remarkable, but then, of course, the military was all called in, And then the spy planes all came in. We're very good spies, by the way. It makes me feel better about your tax dollars. The planes from 80,000 feet took incredibly detailed pictures, which literally rewrote the map of Alaska, found inlets that they had never seen before, all kinds of things. And when they would sense, there were also, you could take some infrared pictures, that kind of thing, and when they would sense something that they couldn't tell what it was, and send a helicopter down to see what the heat object was, it would often just be a log. Or they did find some World War II wrecks, that kind of thing. So I've got to believe the plane went to the bottom of the sea. I mean, that's the most likely explanation. It's also the most comforting.
Probably people have suggested all kinds mysterious, yes. Mystical, magical.
Oh, yes. The combination of conspiracy theorists and psychics, it stays around all the time. Most of them, I hasten to say, people trying really to be helpful.
Mm-hmm.
But you can expect sort of a letter a month from somebody saying,
still.
Oh, yeah.
What did you and your family do during the period of this massive search?
Well, I was living in California at the time. I was, I must have been about 27 or 8 years old, and I had two little kids. And I got on a plane, of course, and came to Washington. And as soon as I arrived in Washington, I got to the house, which, of course, was jammed with people, and casseroles, the usual. And my mother said, oh, thank God you're here. We're going to Alaska. And I said, are you crazy? This is nuts. What are we going to do in Alaska? And here we are surrounded by friends and family and support and all of that. And she said, if we were in Alaska and lost, he'd come look for us. So we went to Alaska. And actually, the trip was quite wonderful because it was on, I guess, Air Force Two. The president was very nice about that, President Nixon. And we that sort of period of flying across from Washington to Alaska sort of all night long was the one little moment of being in a womb, and it was a nice time together. But then we got there, and we were briefed about the searches and all of that, and it's very good that we went for two reasons. One, we would have never understood how you could not find the plane had we not actually been there and seen the expanse that is Alaska. One of my memories of it, that we were staying at Elmendorf Air Force Base, and they could not have been more gracious to us. But one of the things they did, they didn't quite know what to do with us, and one of the things they did was sort of put on their usual show that they did for visiting dignitaries, the threat. And the threat included a map, which I've never forgotten, which was the map of Alaska superimposed over what they graciously called the lower 48. And when you do that, Alaska is the easternmost and westernmost state. Isn't that incredible?
Yeah.
With the Aleutians in the panhandle, it goes out to the, it becomes the easternmost and westernmost state. And at that point, it only had 600 miles of paved road. So, of course, you can get lost in Alaska. You know, everybody treats little planes the way that we treat automobiles. You know, you might put your seatbelt on, and this was before we were as seatbelt conscious as we are now. All of that. So that was a very useful thing. Secondly, our presence at the briefings made them search harder.
Mm-hmm.
We were there, and we asked terrible questions. The men were so embarrassed. It was, and in fact, the Air Force had been searching, and then the Navy came in, and the Navy briefer said, "I've been told the men are fine. It's the women you have to watch out for." This was me, my sister, and sister-in-law. And we just kept asking questions that you know, I still ask to this day, questions that guys think are dumb,
like,
which are the questions everybody else wants to know the answer to, which is like, so why don't you send the Boy Scouts across Portage Pass if that's what it's going to take, you know?
Was there a moment where you and the rest of your family decided from here on in we will just assume that he has passed?
No. No. First of all, I think my mother felt that that would be letting down the search and the searchers and him. Secondly, the necessities of politics, he had to be elected. He disappeared on October 16th, and Election Day wasn't until November. So he was elected. And then as we children, grown children, became more and more desirous of some sort of ceremony to end it, my mother, first of all, was very reluctant to ever give up. But secondly, again, the congressional necessities became the operative thing. So Congress convened in January, and his seat was declared vacant. And at that point, we then had a big memorial service in New Orleans. So, but it is one of the reasons that I am very, very sympathetic to the MIA families. What most of these people are talking about, and I think that our policymakers have taken a very long time to understand this, is not finding a missing parent, brother, husband alive. Some people hold out that hope, obviously. But what most people want is an end point. They want the dignity of burying their dead.
We'll return to our interview with Cokie Roberts after the short break. This is Fresh Air. We're featuring an interview with NPR and ABC political analyst Cokie Roberts. It was recorded last night at the WHYY Forum Theater.
Your sister died of cancer a couple of years ago, I think it was. She had been the mayor of Princeton, and that was a situation where you knew she was dying, and it was probably a slow process and a process that had that sense of finality. Is that something you talked about in the family?
Oh, absolutely. Barbara was a wonderful poet as well as politician, but the two go hand in hand more often than you would think. And she wrote a great deal of poetry around her death, but she also had written a poem when Alaska named a mountain after my father, Mount Boggs. They named a mountain after my father, she wrote. And she talked about how to have a burial, you need a body, and that all of the rituals of death that we have practiced from time out of mind, we have obviously practiced for a reason. And so she insisted on having an open casket in the year 1990, which was quite remarkable. But she felt strongly, even though the whole town had really watched her die, and she had done it valiantly and incredibly, that she wanted them to see her dead and know that she was gone, not have any thoughts that, you know, she might come walking back in someday.
Your mother took over your father's seat. Did you watch her change a lot when she went from congressman's wife to congressperson?
Not really. My mother is a very centered person, so she knew exactly who she was, and she wasn't ever going to change who she was. My sister teased her, and she turned out to be exactly right, that the thing my mother would hate most about Congress would be voting, because what she had done always all those years was be the peacemaker. And because Louisiana, for so many years before the Republicans became a real force, had been a one-party state, the Democrats had had so many factions going that Daddy, because he wasn't a local official, it was a federal official, was endorsed by all of them. But that meant you couldn't pick a campaign director, manager from any one of them. So Mama always managed his campaigns. And she pretty much ran the local office. And you know, he'd vote one way, and she'd explain to the people that he had voted against that he didn't really mean it, that he really still loved them, you know. And the people that he had voted for, not to get too cocky here, you know, there'd be another vote down along the way. And when she had to actually go in there and push the button, Barbara said to her mother, "There's no maybe button." And she hated it. It was true.
Okay, one more family member we've got a question about.
Okay.
That's your brother is a partner in one of the biggest lobbying firms in
law
Washington.
Law firms.
He's actually a lawyer. Right, yes. Thank you.
And 3 years of law school.
It's been a bad year for the image of lobbyists. But, I mean, this is the kind of thing you have to discuss in your political analysis, the role of lobbyists and lawyer lobbyists on Congress, on the political process. Have you said things that that he's objected to? Do you feel like you're influenced by his position at all?
I don't know if I've said things he's objected to, but, you know, whatever I've said is mild compared to what most people have said, so how could he object?
There are many
times when he has been a terrific source, unlike my mother, who always kept her mouth shut. Again, I do have more respect for these institutions than most Americans. Keep in mind that the first right in the First Amendment, before they get to us in the freedom of the press, is the right to petition the Congress. And the lobbyists are there petitioning the Congress, and they're petitioning the Congress on behalf of, you know, the United Church Women of America and the Boy Scouts and Greenpeace and Texaco, you know, and Guatemala or whatever. And I think that is the function they perform. There are, if you want to talk about money in politics, that's a very different part of the equation. And my personal view is that most lobbyists in Washington would be thrilled to stop having to raise the kind of money they currently have to raise. They hate it. The members of Congress hate it. Everybody hates the current system. They can't figure out an easy way to get out of it. And the only way that they can figure to get out of it involves public financing, which is very difficult to vote for and go home and defend. So that you're really in many positions damned either way.
One more question. I think, you know, from the outside looking in at your life, you seem to be somebody who has everything in a way, you know, a wonderful family, a fantastic career. Everybody admires your work and so on. I think most people end up feeling that they've sacrificed so much to have what they have and that they have enough of one thing but not enough of something else. What do you feel that you've sacrificed? Do you feel that there's like an important ingredient that's been missing in your life? Or do you feel like you've really had a balance that you're very comfortable with?
I've had a much better balance than most women are able to achieve. And my message to young women always is that I think that the important thing to remember is you've got a long life ahead of you for most people. I mean, they'll be in the workforce for 50 years. And you don't have to do everything at once. I said no to lots of good jobs along the way because they were inappropriate for my family at that time. Mm-hmm. At one point when we were in Greece and CBS was very interested in my doing more, it would have just been wrong. The children would have had two parents traveling all the time. What's the point of having parents? And I feel strongly that you can say no to something, and that's not the last time someone will ever offer you that. The one thing you do run out of time on is the ability to have a family. Your children, and then once you have children, they're only going to be young for a certain number of years. Your parents are only going to be old for a certain number of years. You're only going to have sicknesses that you need to deal with and take care of for certain periods of time. Those are the things where you have to say, this is the priority now, because it's not going to be here ever again. And work will always be there, all too much. So I think that the choices that I have made have almost entirely been family first. That's not to say that on any given day, of course, or week or month, that I haven't worked around the clock and barely seen everybody. But in big life choices, they have been family first, and I that's one of those situations where you just don't regret it. I suppose if I had to say what's missing is that I still feel that I don't have enough time to spend with friends or with people who I think need some special care at this special moment for whatever reason. But I sure try.
Yeah. Cookie, thank you.
Thank you, Terry.
Cookie Roberts is political analyst for NPR and ABC TV. We spoke last night at the WHYY Forum Theater. The event was organized by WHYY's Art Ellis. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert, what will you have today on American policy toward Bosnia?
Well, Ann Garrell's reports on President Clinton's meeting with the Russian foreign minister, and then the rather different accounts that he and the Russian gave of their meeting, and where U.S. policy toward Bosnia seems to stand right now. We'll be hearing from Deborah Amos in Belgrade about events there in the Balkans. Also on today's program, Linda Gradstein reports on the greater strength among more militant Palestinian groups since the peace talks began. Linda Wertheimer talks with the author of a new biography of the great lawyer Clarence Darrow. And a contest to see if our audience can come up with the kinds of titles for policies that policies now seem to have.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. When Sharon Stone's breakthrough movie Basic Instinct opened last year, her name wasn't even on the posters. In her new film Sliver, she has top billing. Sliver, like Basic Instinct, was written by Joe Esterhaas, who based his screenplay on a novel by Ira Levin. Pinch-hitting movie critic Kevin Whitehead says that for Stone, this high-rise thriller is no step up.
First off, let me own up, I liked Basic Instinct, which critic Chuck Stevens ID'd as the lost, X-rated Streets of San Francisco episode. Its saving grace was the maligned Sharon Stone, whose molten sexual presence gave it whatever credibility it had. Before that, in Total Recall, she was just a bimbo Schwarzenegger blew away with a gun and a punchline. Now, Stone is a top-billed star. And she wants to show us that the sexpot thing is just acting by not playing one in Sliver. It's a dubious career move. Stone plays Carly Norris, a divorce-scarred Manhattan book editor with mousy hair and a sleepwalker's distant voice. She's just moved into the chic Sliver building in Midtown. But there's something a little funny about the place, as she begins to find out from a slightly creepy neighbor, played by veteran actor Keane Curtis.
You just really, well, you look like someone.
Someone you like or someone you dislike?
Oh, no, I liked her a lot. What's really strange is she was in 20B as well. Naomi Singer.
When did she move?
Well, she didn't. She jumped out the window.
When Carly moves in, she's withdrawn from life and from men. She gets her big thrills from putting golf balls into a coffee mug on the carpet. Hey, I wonder if that's symbolic. Now, a sexually repressed Sharon Stone makes about as much sense as having Keane Curtis do a nude scene, which he does. Anyway, Carly starts to feel like she's being watched. And in fact, every inch of the building is monitored by hidden video cameras. But who's watching? The janitor who futzes with the lobby security camera? Keane Curtis, who teaches an NYU course called The Psychology of the Lens? Or is it one of the two guys coming on to her? Zeke, the computer ace played by William Baldwin, or Tom Berenger's Jack, a breezy but overbearing investigative journalist? We find out pretty quick, but it's not clear if the voyeur is the killer. Even so, the real mystery is, if the building's full of high-tech electronics, why do the lights keep flickering like the place was wired by someone's brother-in-law? The whole movie's sort of an exercise in dysfunctional mechanics. Director Philip Noyce never gives the audience a jolt. A woman enters a dark stairwell, and you know she's going to get killed. Brian De Palma could milk this for 5 minutes easy. Here it's like, who cares? People talk dirty or they flash their butts, and Carly gets over her fear of sex after 20 seconds of strenuous acting, but it's all pretty unsexy. Sliver keeps missing its opportunities. In one scene, Zeke takes Carly to a swank restaurant and bullies her into letting him see her panties. For a second, it looks like a sly critique of Stone's most notorious scene in Basic Instinct, but this movie doesn't have that much wit. The scene finally settles for naughty laughs. In the home stretch, this video-obsessed film becomes another big-screen indictment of watching television and half-heartedly deals with the moral implications of voyeurism, sort of a Rear Window remade by the Super Mario Brothers. It's like someone thought the movie can't have soul because video isn't supposed to. A final plot twist makes it all even less satisfying. Labored as the movie is, you realize you've been giving it too much credit. There's not a lot to Sliver, and what there is ain't too sharp.
Kevin Whitehead is a critic and record annotator based in New York. Stephen Schiff returns from the Cannes Film Festival next week. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Sue Weinstein. Thanks today to Art Ellis, research assistance from Penny Nelson. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, how CFCs, chlorofluorocarbons, went from being the miracle compound to the biggest threat to the ozone layer. We talk with Seth Kagan and Philip Dre, authors of Between Earth and Sky, How CFCs Changed Our World and Endangered the Ozone Layer. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.